Hello, happy Sunday, or whatever day it is you're listening to History of Westeros podcast. We're so glad you're here with us, and we're here to have fun talking about some more world building as a springboard to what we might expect in the future of the series, understanding the material better, and just having a great time while we're at it. And Sean, what today have you placed in your cup of wonder, cup of random, cup of mystery? What's it got?
I think I have more different things mixed than normal. I've got the protein berry naked drink and the rainbow machine naked drink.
Rainbow, appropriate. It's Pride Month, yeah.
Yes, yes. And also peach Red Bull and watermelon Mountain Dew. And I thought, one of the sparkling ices, the raspberry sparkling
ice. That is a lot of things, man. That is like a half a dozen things, which is appropriate for today because Lorath has a lot of different qualities. An unusual combination of traits, which Sean's drink also has. I don't know if there's many raspberries in Lorath. It's a northern spot, so I would say they definitely don't have raspberries there. But they probably have the occasional rainbow and other fruits, perhaps. Shout out to our friend Nina for her notes. Always invaluable, always very helpful. Check out her blog at goodqueenally.tumblr.com. That's one L in Ally. Latest blog post. She got a question wondering about if Viserys, as in the Viserys I from Dance of the Dragons fame, had followed through with his Rhaenyra, Prince of Dorne marriage plan. Would that have worked out? I suggest you check it out to find out the answer. As always, you can ask questions live or ahead of time. Join the discussion on Facebook, History of Westeros Facebook group, or on Discord. Lots of good discussions happening on both. And Shea, we got some news this week, didn't we?
Yeah, we sure did. Aziz and I got confirmation yesterday that we will be doing a panel at San Diego Comic-Con this year on Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon. This is a fan panel with Amin from a podcast of Ice and Fire and Tara of Ice and Fire Con and Geek Saga. And so that's pretty cool because George R. R. Martin will be in attendance at San Diego Comic-Con this year. And there should be a rather sizable House of the Dragon presence as well. So if you're in the San Diego area or California and want to come out and have a little meetup, we could certainly do one off campus that is not part of Comic-Con. But you could also come to our panel when the date is announced. So please let us know about that.
Yeah, we'll let you know once we get more detail. And it's pretty exciting. This is just like Shea said, we just found out this week. So that's good that worked out for us. Let's have a trivia question, shall we? The question is, related to wonders of the world, both natural and unnatural. Well, really, unnatural meaning man-made. That would actually be a really good category, like unnatural, the sorrows and the Shadowlands and the Doom of Valyria, just things that aren't quite right that are probably magical or definitely magical in some cases. But that isn't the question we have today. Let me stay on topic here. The question is, which region or place or city, which place has two wonders of the world, according to Lomas Longstrider? Answer, as usual, at the end.
Would you, Aziz, would you count in this world of Martin's dragons as unnatural?
Well, that's a good question. I think I would, yes. I think they are too fantastical to be not unnatural. I mean, to be not unnatural.
Especially because they've been gone for a while, although relatively short while in the history of this world.
Historical stuff,
If dinosaurs were brought back and just, if scientists used the genes and spliced them up and suddenly this, is that unnatural? If dinosaurs were real, they're not fantastic really, but for them to exist now, it is. So.
Yeah, I think arguably bringing something back that went extinct is unnatural, but I guess it depends on your definition of natural. Yeah. I would say yes. If we have a real life Jurassic Park, I'm going to go ahead and call that unnatural. That doesn't mean I don't want it though, because I want to see a dinosaur or two in a cage where it can't get to anyone. I don't want them out there, just roaming the neighborhood. Lorath. Let's talk Lorath. It possesses many of the great qualities you want in a fantasy city. Mysterious ancient architecture, bizarrely unique customs, a weird god, supernatural legends and creatures and a connection to dragon lords. You know, that's always fun. This would make a particularly excellent role-playing setting as either a basis or a place to adventure in, I think.
I even wondered as I was reading about it, if that's what it was. If it was some piece of a role-playing adventure Martin or some group of his friends had that he incorporated into the world. It seems so well set up for it.
That's a great theory. Like, I obviously it occurred to me that it would work as that, but didn't occur to me that it was that and that George borrowed it, maybe his own role-playing or just ideas he's taken from role-playing. You know, it's like, you know what, I'm going to borrow some from my D&D days. I'm sure that actually happens all over Westeros and Essos, but it feels like it's more concentrated here than in a lot of other places. By the same token, this episode is lighter than a lot of our World of Ice and Fire episodes on real world influences. You know, Volantis, for example, has a lot in common with New Orleans, Braavos with Venice, Tyrosh with Tyre. Bear Island in Westeros is matched by 28 or 29 Bear Islands in the real world, plus several others that have bears that aren't called Bear Island. Those all matched up pretty well. Casterly Rock and the Rock of Gibraltar, the Wall and Hadrian's Wall, the Titan of Braavos, and the Colossus of Rhodes. Of course, these aren't all one-to-one parallels, but they are very strong, influential starting points. And of course, these when they are one-to-one parallels, they don't remotely tell the full story, but they're an anchor, a place to start. Lorath arguably doesn't really have a starting point like that. There's a couple of places we have suggested here that we'll get to in a minute that are similar, but they're not overwhelming parallels. They're more like, yeah, this has some things in common with that. And that applies to the island itself and the people. So both things together and individually. So it will require a little more imagination on our parts, but hey, that's really fun. I like when we get to imagine more. It's fitting with the role-playing element and all that, the high fantasy stuff maybe. It's kind of high and low, right? There's like high fantasy, but it's not like people casting lots of spells. It's still George's version of high fantasy where it's still maybe stuff happened, maybe mysterious things happen, but there still aren't like wizards and lightning bolts flying around. So we've got a few tidbits about mazes and labyrinths from the real world, though. Lower amount of real world stuff. There's definitely some, and that's going to reveal a few surprises and connections I think you all will enjoy. So let's get to it with the place we often start, which is with first mentions. We'll begin with the first time it was mentioned at all, as usual. Dany Six, Game of Thrones, when she's asking Jorah Mormont to help her convince Drogo that he should invade Westeros.
The knight looked thoughtful. "The Call has never seen the Seven Kingdoms," he said. "They are nothing to him. If he thinks of them at all, no doubt he thinks of islands, a few small cities clinging to rocks in the manner of Lorath or Lys, surrounded by stormy seas. The riches of the East must seem more tempting prospect."
Yeah, I mean, Drogo, speaking of leading his Khalasar towards the lands of the Jade Sea, which may have originally been part of George's narrative plan to get Dany closer to Ashai. And that was also part of his plan. He was going to have her find her dragon eggs originally in the wilderness beyond Vase Dothrak. So obviously he changed that. And Nina writes, "And since the Dothraki avoid the poison water for religious/cultural reasons because they distrust any water that horses can't drink, a call like Drogo might well see a place like Lorath as a place inhabited by, say, bizarre barbarians. Who would voluntarily live in a place surrounded on all sides by poison water?" Yeah, like from a Dothraki perspective, it would be a strange place to live and a bizarre place to want to go because, yeah, he's not wrong. As Jorah says, it is pretty poor. I mean, Lys isn't poor, but still, the East is richer by far and more relevantly, not across the water. So, yeah.
I think it would be really interesting. Just, it's such a different choice to have Dany find her eggs in the wilderness. There's a lot of meaning behind how she got her eggs.
Yeah, it would have been kind of random just to find them. Yeah, I think it's much better than this gift. It's just so much more meaningful and with the lyrics.
Yeah, I think it was the better choice as well. I do. Yeah. Otherwise, it's more of like a MacGuffin kind of like thing. Where, she found her magical eggs.
Yeah.
It definitely makes a lot of sense, but it also is just interesting in terms of what it means for Dany as a character in terms of being given her eggs versus finding them. And it just speaks a lot to her character as well.
I wonder if George is going to have a dream like the voices lead her to them rather than just stumble on them by accident. Because,
well, it could also parallel them finding the dire wolves at the beginning of Game of Thrones.
Maybe that's what he was aiming for. Yeah,
a little parallel there.
Good. So, yeah, so you can see why Drogo wouldn't have been interested in Lorath. He might not have been interested in a place like Lorath, even if it was attached to the mainland. Because yeah, it's just he's after glory and power and riches, and you don't really get that as a Dothraki call by attacking Lorath. You go after bigger targets. So what I think Lorath is placed in the narrative, its niche is it's the remote, but not too remote locale. It's not Ashai. It's not super far away where you have to take ship and travel like a year or start there like Dany, who then goes farther east, gradually getting there. So I think that's its role. It sounds really far away. It sounds remote. It sounds exotic, but it's not prohibitively so. It's in that sort of just on the cusp range. Now here's another quote. The first appearance of Lorath in the world of Ice and Fire. Now, since we'll eventually cover all 9 free cities, we'll likely find this particular first mention of Lorath is also going to be the first mention of some of the other cities. So we'll probably hear this quote again at some point, but we'll, of course, deal with it differently. Here it is.
On the shores of Essos, the Valyrians raised cities, which we know today as the Free Cities. Their origins were diverse. Kohor and Norvos were founded following religious schisms. Others, such as Old Volantis and Lys, were trading colonies first and foremost, founded by wealthy merchants and nobles who purchased the right to rule themselves as clients of the freehold rather than subjects. These cities chose their own leaders rather than receiving archons dispatched from Valyria, often on dragonback, to oversee them. It is claimed in some histories that Pentos and Lorath were of a third type, cities already extant before the Valyrians came, whose rulers paid homage to Valyria and thus retained their right to native rule. In these cities, what influx of Valyrian blood there was came from migrants from the freehold or political marriages used to better bind these cities to Valyria.
Right. There wasn't ever a lot of Valyrian people living in Lorath. There's got to be a few. It does business there. But as we've just explained, probably not a lot of business because it's not a wealthy place. There's not a ton of industries there that a super rich person would want to be involved in, especially given its distance from the freehold. As we saw with the freehold, the most powerful people like to keep close to it. And Lorath is pretty damn far. The exceptions like Lys and Volantis that did have a lot of actual Valyrians living there, in part because Lys was, a party spot and Volantis was so close by. Those were the reasons for that, whereas Lorath is neither of those things. So the quote here goes on to say that the source for these claims about Pentos is questionable, given politics and other factors. There's no pushback against Lorath, though. No one argues that Lorath isn't really as old as they claim. Pentos's claims are political. Lorath, nah. The evidence speaks for itself. For quite a few reasons, it's pretty indisputable. So Lorath might be the only one of the 9 that existed before the Valyrians came, which gives it a little bit of additional unique quality. On the point of how it's remote, but not too remote, John actually thinks of sending Arya there. Now, he's actually thinking about fake Arya in this case, because he's heard that Stannis is going to send Arya to him. He thinks that Lorath or Ib might be safer. In other words, it's still not so remote that he can't, find her later if need be. And especially compared to the wall, Lorath isn't super far from there. Again, it's all
he thinks of Braavos first, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He thinks Braavos would be good, but for the same reasons it would be good, it would be bad. It's nearby, mm-hmm. But it's nearby. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's he's
go a little farther out. Yeah.
Yes, but he does, of course, it does end up being Braavos. But well, it doesn't because we don't know. He gets stabbed and Arya, fake Arya isn't even there yet. But that appears to be the decision he was weighing. And that is ironic because if someone sends her to Braavos, then real Arya is there. But hey.
She might run into herself.
Yeah, she might run into herself. And of course, those who know each other, Jane Poole and Arya know each other now. Jane Poole wouldn't recognize Arya in one of her many disguises, but Arya would absolutely recognize Jane Poole, even with her nose missing, which unfortunately.
There would be a lot of interesting potential interactions that we would have there if that happened. Would Arya maintain her lack of self?
Yeah.
If she suddenly saw a childhood friend, could she keep herself together,
Yeah, would it be a little test of her control, her self-control? Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
in addition to being a great role-playing setting, it's got a lot of potential for a TV arc or a video game, right? Well, a video game is similar in the role-playing game aspect. Of course, it's in this thought exercise, it's more about visualizing it, seeing what it looks like, seeing like the mazes with giant stone blocks and this island. That would look fantastic on TV. It's looked really cool in some of the art that's been done for it. Highly recommend checking that out. And the Sea Snake has been there. So once again, that is perhaps our best hope in the short term. If the Sea Snake show happens, then, well, Lorath was on his list. He did go there. So we've got a little hope in that case. Let's talk about the geography of this lovely place. Maybe not so lovely, but interesting place. Only a Lorathi could love Lorath, right? That quote isn't actually in here, but I guess that's got to be our thing now. Only a Lannister could love Castle Rock. Only a Mormont could love Bear Island. Only a Lorathi could love Lorath. The maze. Only a maze maker could love the mazes.
You know, in discussions of like, where would you want to be in the Seven Kingdoms? I want to be in like the Reach. I want to be in some place that anyone could love. Yeah. I don't want to be in some weird, tough, remote place. Yeah.
Give me the fertile, like, yeah, land of plenty. Yeah. I'll take that. Yeah. Yeah. Let me be near Old Town. Let me be near all the stuff and the people. Yeah. The interesting stuff, the books. Yeah. I don't want to be. No yeah. Lorath for me. Thanks. I'm very happy to read about it. But let's leave it at that. So here's the quote describing its sort of basic features and direct geography.
The free city of Lorath stands upon the western end of the largest in a cluster of low, stony islands in the Shivering Sea, north of Essos, near the mouth of Lorath Bay. The city's domains include three principal islands of the archipelago, a score of smaller isles, and outcrops almost all uninhabited save for the seals and seabirds, and thickly forested peninsula south of the isles. The Lorathi also claim dominion over the waters of Lorath Bay, but fishing fleets from Braavos and whalers and sealers out of Ib often venture into the bay, for Lorath does not have sufficient strength to make good on its claim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they don't have a big, say, state navy to enforce that, hey, these are our fishing waters. Probably isn't a big deal, though. I mean, it's probably not. Doesn't sound like it's being overfished. It's not a high population area, and it sounds like there's huge amounts of fish and sea life, so it's not like an issue of supply or anything like that. One of those other three islands is called the Rassion. So like I said, there's three major islands and a bunch of smaller, tiny ones that don't have people. We don't actually know the name of the third. I don't know that anyone really lives there or any substantial number of people live there, but it's worth keeping in the back of your mind. As usual, we're discussing various lengthy periods in history. You know, while Lorath doesn't have the military strength right now to enforce its claim over Lorath Bay and the fishing rights and all that, it has in the past and may once again. There are certainly exceptions like that, so we'll get to those. They have been more dangerous, in other words. Interesting that the first known race of Lorath was said to be destroyed by enemies from the sea. And the modern Lorath, they are preyed upon by neighbors via naval superiority. It must be Lorath's fate to have its enemies come via the sea. Yeah, definitely. Or, as we'll see much later, in one case, they come via air. And you know what that means, because there's only one enemy that comes via air, breathing fire. Mm-hmm. For example, here's a quote that shows perhaps the height of Lorathi power.
In former days, Lorath's rule extended as far east as the Axe, but the city's power has dwindled over the centuries, and today the Lorathi exercise effective control over only the southern and eastern shores of Lorath Bay. The western shore of the bay is part of the domains of Braavos.
Mm. The Axe is just described. It's between Lorath Bay and what was Soth, i.e. Sarnor. You can see or look at the map later if you don't have it up now. At the mouth of the Sarn, which we talked about a lot in our Kingdom of Sarnor episode, is Morash. And Morash is a colony of Lorath. There's some kind of mineral wealth there. There's mining there. And of course, more fishing. The Axe itself is disputed by Ib and Norvas, not by Lorath, but as Ashe just read that quote, Lorath has had control over the Axe in the past, just not currently. There are also some smaller islands in between Braavos and Lorath. They'll come up a few times today. They've at various times held populations and have been fought over. Liat Rubenfeld, frequent commenter, quite often has some great takes and very helpful things to say. They say it's a bit like Iceland, perhaps. Sean, what do you think of this take? You looked into this a little bit. I think it seems, it's got some similarities, right?
Yeah, there's quite a few. Similar to Lorath, it's been under the control of different entities over time, like through the Napoleonic Wars and World War II, but it still mostly maintained its identity, if you will, you know. And it's also had several moments of its population, which we haven't got to yet, but we see this happens a couple times through the course of Lorath, several moments of its population being like severely, you know, huge portions wiped out, like a couple times a result of a volcano going off, which put ash in the air and the livestock died and people starved. It was hit by the Black Plague a couple different times. So several times, like a third or half of its population has been destroyed. Its economy is hugely based on fishing, sea life. 50% of its exports come from that.
Okay.
In modern times, it's gotten into more into manufacturing stuff. But it's also has a nearly non-existent military. It doesn't really have, it has a coast guard, you know, but that's about all that it has.
Okay.
And also something that we talked about it a couple times in the past was the effects of like climate change. And we were like relating it to how it might be like the long night. Mm-hmm. There was like a mini ice age in real history. Same thing. At the time that humans first started settling in Iceland, it was a relatively warm period of time.
Oh.
And that at that time, a quarter of Iceland was covered with forests. Now it's only 1%.
Really?
Probably part of that is from they chopped down the trees for firewood and build houses and stuff. But also it's just just the climate has changed. It got colder. That's another time. It was like a mass exit of population from Iceland as the climate got colder and it couldn't sustain the amount of people that were living there.
Wow.
Anyway, lots of parallels.
That's true.
But it also has some big differences. Lorath doesn't have it. Like Iceland has a constant active volcano. Like it's Lorath full of lava fields and geysers. By the way, the word geyser comes from a spout of water in Iceland. It was called geyser, and that name just started to be called any kind of spout of water like that. So anyway, while there are some clear parallels, I don't know for sure if Martin was meaning to draw from it.
Maybe. That's unclear. You're right, though. There's definitely a lot of things that has in common, but it's not clear if Martin was drawing on it. Certainly a remote area. Yeah, there's a lot. And we'll, as we go forward, we'll probably draw out some more of these parallels, and maybe you'll just notice them on your own. So yeah, it's not a bustling area like Iceland. There's not major wealth in food or minerals. Here's another quote.
Lorath is the smallest, poorest, and least populous of the nine first cities. Save for Braavos, it is also the northernmost. Its location, far from trade routes, has helped make it the most isolated of the Daughters of Valyria that was. Just to get thinking, this is even more parallel to Iceland, is that its population, even now, I think is less than 500,000. Mm. Like most of history, its population was like 20 or 40,000 or something like that. It's relatively small compared to the rest of Europe. But it is still significant, even though it's relatively small. It doesn't have the same wealth as some of the other countries. It is a little farther and more, you know, desolate or isolated, but it is still one of the most successful countries in the world by a lot of measures. You know what I mean? It's very progressive as far as women's rights, and it's had a lot of
healthcare is really cheap there, I believe.
Wealth of the people there is very high. It's like many like measures of how societies do. It's like in a top three of many, many measures. I don't know if Lorath quite hits that. Maybe it hasn't had time to develop into that, but it is just another parallel that Iceland is so much farther north than the rest of Europe and so more distant and smaller populated.
Yeah, you might have. I know they do really well in health metrics. Like Lorath maybe does as well. There's, you know, fewer people, fewer diseases, fewer like all that lack of trade isn't great. But the positive side is you're a lot less likely to get some random plague from halfway across the globe, which we've seen happen all over Westeros. Like Gulltown, King's Landing, they get hit by these nasty plagues that Lorath would be a little less likely to get hit by. Or maybe a lot less. So that's a nice benefit as well. Nina points out that Lorath is about on the same latitude as the Twins, farther north than the Eyrie or Gulltown, but obviously farther south than East Seton and North. So that's a great point to keep in mind. Yes, this is as far north as Essos goes, but if you look at the map, I mean, Ib is actually as far north as Essos goes. But the north of Westeros is far farther north than anything we know of in Essos. And that's something that I think we forget occasionally. We might think that Lorath or Braavos is like aligned with those spots. No. when they sail out of Eastwatch by the sea and go south, it's straight over. But that's all the way at the north of the wall, right? So yeah, and there's all that lands beyond the wall. That's why it's called that, right? Keep that in mind. That said, here is a description of just further description of the isles themselves and what's around them.
Though the Lorathi Isles themselves are bleak and stony, the surrounding waters teem with shoals of cod, whales, and gray leviathans that gather and breed in the bay. And the outlying rocks and sea stacks are home to great colonies of walrus and seal, salt cod, walrus tusks, seal skins, and whale oil form the greater part of the city's trade.
Take note of the walruses. Walry? What's the plural of walruses? And seals for later. There's a little bit of lore around them. So you'll want to keep that in mind. But for the most part, those are not big money trade goods, right? Salt, cod, seal skins, whale oil. I mean, those are, you can definitely make some cash off that, but that's not gold or gems. Nina says, now ivory from walruses, that is pretty big business. Ivory is a fairly wealthy trade good. She says that, for example, the Vikings in Greenland made items from walrus ivory, from chess pieces to sword hilts to jewelry, and those were traded as far as Kiev, Constantinople, Baghdad. So that's pretty substantial. And we do definitely have ivory trade in A Song of Ice and Fire. Jaehaerys Lannister gave Robert a dagger with an ivory hilt. Ivory trade exists among the free folk. For example, Davos remembers trading for it while serving, you know, up there. And yeah, we got to figure that's a big chunk of their economy. Because there's so many walruses, there's got to be a lot of tusks available for them to sell. It's one of those combo names where Lorath is both the name of the island and the city. Lys is the same. Lorath Bay was mentioned around throughout these quotes, and that is the general region it sits in. But always an important perspective to keep in mind. This is a good one, isn't it, Sean? We think about, we call it Lorath. It's written as Lorath in the common tongue, and this would be true for a lot of places in the real world. Not everyone calls it Iceland, right? It's had a lot of different names over a lot of different times. And the more different cultures you're aware of that have lived in a place, just the more different names it's going to have had. And Lorath has had a lot of different cultures and types of people living there. It's one of the things that makes it very unique, very distinct, is it's got these very delineated periods where different cultures live there and then either were wiped out or left or what have you. That implies that it's been called a lot of different things over the years by a lot of different peoples. And I put peoples in quotes because some of them are not human. Oh, not human, you say. Well, right there, we're tickling some fancies. Indeed, indeed, we are. But I am really fascinated by that. That not only the different ethnic groups that took over, but usually they were gone or were killed off before the next group moved in. So there wasn't that much mingling. There's definitely some examples where there was mingling. But that kind of stands out, doesn't it, Sean? There hasn't been a lot of other spots like this that we've seen.
Yeah, I was going to say that is something that is pretty unique about it, is it was, you know, one culture and that culture went away and the new one came and that went away and a new one came. Rather than this constant melding, it seems like it could have been. And some of these islands maybe are more melting pots of cultures, but this one has been more singular, I guess, just changing from one to another rather than absorbing multiple in.
And I guess part of the reason why is all the stuff we just said. If it was some amazing, fertile, wealthy place, it would never be left alone for so long. It would also be a lot harder to wipe everyone out. There would have been so many people there in the first place.
Or if it was more central. If it was a spot that had more traffic going by it. But it's just at the north end. So like a difference between the stepstones. There's not some reason for this constant traffic to be flowing past it. I don't want to go too far before we forget the new word that you coined. Perspection.
Okay. Yeah, we'll have to try to use that one again, right? It's an official word of the History of Westeros podcast. Perspection. Well, let's turn our perspection.
I Googled perspection.
Is it a real world or not? Real world or not?
Unclear. The website Lexico, powered by Oxford, says perspection is a rare noun that means contemplation, regard, scrutiny, inspection. So yes. Yeah. It's a real world. I said world too, damn. Jeez.
Bad talk, infectious.
I guess it's kind of like introspection, perspection. Contemplate. Anyways, interesting.
Nice. Well, let's do some maze-spection here. The first people who lived in Lorath that we know of were the maze makers. Here's a little quote about them.
In ancient days, the Isles were home to the mysterious race of men known as the maze makers, who vanished long before the dawn of true history, leaving no trace of themselves save for their bones and the mazes they built.
Yeah, so let's start off by just setting some definitions out real quick. The difference between a maze and a labyrinth. Usually, when people are just talking about, mazes and labyrinths, the word is used interchangeably. Technically, if you want to be technically correct, though, and Sean, what is technically correct?
The best kind of correct.
Correct. So that's real meta. So you're correct about the best kind of correct. Yeah. Labyrinth is more like a path. It's called a unicursal. If you follow the path, you don't get lost. One way in, one way out, or the way in is the way out. It's often symbolic of a spiritual journey, growth, or transition, especially transitioning to the underworld or the next life. It's a death thing, right? At the center is this new realm, either represented by it symbolically or metaphorically or whatever. Some kind of awakening, enlightenment is at the center of this. Think of Westworld. If you watch the show Westworld, there was the labyrinth. They didn't call it a labyrinth. They used the word maze. But that was really more of a labyrinth, the way I believe. Well, maybe you could say it was a maze. I don't remember the exact pattern of it. But regardless, the concept in Westworld was understanding, enlightenment. At the center of this maze labyrinth was human consciousness for these AI beings, right?
I think the people who made Westworld need to have some enlightenment of their own.
Yeah. <That's>
it started off really well, but man.
It became more of a maze. They thought the plot was a labyrinth, but it turned into a maze.
Yeah.
Because a maze is a place designed to create confusion and has dead ends, which Westworld definitely had some dead end plot lines and stuff like that. And it definitely created some confusion in the process. So sorry, Westworld fans. I'm still going to watch the rest of that show. I'll watch the final season.
Yeah, me too. But
it definitely got lost.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Izzy.
It's pretty funny. It's pretty meta that the show that has featured all these mazes and labyrinths got lost on itself. That's very meta. But is that ever how you think about it, Sean? Or were you aware of that definition? Or
I didn't exactly know the difference between them. And when what you wrote out made a lot of sense, but it spurred me to look deeper.
Oh, cool.
And even think of it in different ways too. So generally speaking, the words at this point have become somewhat synonymous.
Yes, yes.
There may be like a fundamental original difference, but they get used synonymously. But here's one way to reconcile the idea of a labyrinth. And it also might be that one might be a subcategory of the other. But anyway, here's my point. You could have a labyrinth where there's only one way in and one way out, and only one path to get through from the way in to the way out. But within there might be other paths intermixed that you could get lost in.
Yeah. Okay.
Whereas a maze could have multiple ways in, multiple ways out, multiple ways to get from the entrance to the exit.
Mm.
But you still also could get lost running to dead ends. Whereas the labyrinth will only have one correct way through. A maze might have multiple different correct ways through.
Yeah.
Even though both of them might be confusing or have dead ends or whatever else.
And if you're thinking in the spiritual, like enlightenment perspective, like if you've taken a different path, you've taken a different path, right? Like you have chosen a different form of enlightenment or to not be enlightened or some other. So there's a lot of like thick metaphor in here.
Yes. A lot of potential for the words to be used with greater meaning.
Yeah.
Well, one other little side note, maze, you even bring this up a little bit later on, but maze came from like Northern Europe, like Old English. Whereas labyrinth came from Mediterranean Latin.
Yeah.
So they originated separately, which would also add to like nuances in definition or use. But eventually you can see why they would get intermixed.
Yeah. I've actually got a little more on that point in a few minutes here. But let's go back to Braavos for a second. We have maybe something that's related to the maze makers. Maybe not. It might just be a similar concept. Because again, this is a human concept that's come up in many places. The idea, whether it's coming up in Westworld or ancient Greece, or whatever, or in the UK, like you just said, Sean, I did notice through reading that England is particularly fond of mazes. I think England is the maze capital of the world, probably. That's something to know. But when Arya is learning Braavos, she's obviously spends a lot of time there, and there's a lot of different gods worshiped there because it's a land of many peoples. And there's a snippet that has this list of a bunch of different gods she's being told about. And here is this particular one, this one's particularly strange god that sounds similar.
And there, the entrance to the pattern maker's maze. Only those who learn to walk it properly will ever find their way to wisdom, the priests of the pattern say.
Uh-huh. So it could be just a different approach on the same concepts, because it doesn't explicitly make any connection to the maze makers. Maybe the pattern maker's a fan of the maze makers. Don't know. The patternist could be a reference to Robert Jordan.
Copycat engineers.
Yeah. Robert Jordan, of course, the author of Wheel of Time. The pattern is reality in the Wheel of Time world. And George has dropped several Easter eggs about the Wheel of Time. So this could be another one of those. That would make Robert Jordan the pattern maker, I suppose, in this case. I lean towards it being a related concept, but it could be, you know, inspired by the Mazemakers, like a religion of humanity inspired by these ancient beings, whoever they were. But
especially because they're right next to each other.
Yeah.
It's not hard close. At all yeah. to believe that someone from Braavos in ancient times visited Lorath and then came back with this insight or this idea, or vice versa. You know, someone from Lorath came to Braavos and brought it with them. And then through the course of time, it would have branched in its own direction. Language drift turns, you know, maze to pattern, records being wiped out and so on. It makes a lot of sense to me for them to be connected.
Yeah, I mean, you got to figure like a lot of probably real world religions started that way. Someone discovered an older religion, was like, I bet I could bring this around again. They knew what they were doing with this belief system. A lot of people would follow this. They might have a little bit of, you know, cynicism, a little ulterior motive with that in mind, but maybe not. Maybe they just honestly stumbled on it and were like, oh, I'm enlightened now. I need to spread the word.
There's a lot of thought around a lot of early religious founders that they are likely to have had the same central source or even communication with each other, Jesus and Buddha and characters like that. You know,
some great coalition of leaders that were like, okay, here's how we do it. Here's how to make a religion. Let's work on this. But this idea, this only walking the pattern properly to learn wisdom, this really resonates for a lot of characters, Bran, maybe most of all, but definitely Dany as well, John, perhaps, even someone like Stannis. Of course, if it resonates for Dany, a lot of things that apply to Dany also apply to Stannis and vice versa, because they're on similar tracks. Melisandre, you could argue as well, is looking for the wisdom of how to defeat the others, but she's a little off on who the savior is, things like that. You know, these concepts are very resonant within A Song of Ice and Fire. And it's interesting that they're applied to these very young characters. These are people who aren't supposed to have had a long time to reach enlightenment or have had long life experiences. They're thrust in these roles at a very early age. So it's not something they have a lot of time to sit back and think about. But undoubtedly, the characters in the story will thrive or die or somewhere in between based on the level of wisdom they have and what they learn along the way. That's going to make a huge difference. And in Bran's case, he's specifically has some access to knowledge that was gathered by many, many beings before him. So there's this path of wisdom. Can he learn from that? Or should he learn from that? Or somewhere in between, maybe. I don't know. I don't walk the same path of wisdom. I couldn't answer that question. It's beyond all of us. That's the point. The path of wisdom isn't so easy to spot. So that's why mazes are a really interesting and appreciable metaphor for such things, for decisions. It's like Dany at the House of the Undying. Which way should she go? Which stair should she take? Well, the path of wisdom said always take the door on the right. But it wasn't always easy to tell what the door on the right was. Like, it got confusing for her. So I think this is, it's not always easy to see where this pops up in A Song of Ice and Fire, but it really does in quite a few very important times. It's not like a constant thing, but it pops up at some of the really crucial moments like House of the Undying or Bran's Weirwood visions or things like that. And of course, any character that leaves home at the beginning of the story, spend several books out in the world only to find themselves back at home at the end. That's a labyrinthine journey, right?
Didn't Sam say something about there being no way he could have found his way through the tunnel under the wall without someone's...
Cold Hands told him, and then he told Bran that they wouldn't have never found it without his help in turn because he had been told. Yeah. Good point.
Is that like wisdom, if you will? Like someone showing you the way?
It's a little more straightforward, but it falls into that auspice, I think. I think you're right. That umbrella. So here's another little real world bit. The most famous labyrinth in the world, at least for us Westerners, is most certainly the one on Crete at Knossos, which the legendary / mythical Minotaur was said to exist with Theseus and Ariadne and King Minos and all that good stuff. This one's confusing, though, because it's debatable. It's called a labyrinth, which means it should have the path, but all the accounts of it are a maze. It's got multiple ways in, multiple ways out. Why would you need the thread to follow? Why would Theseus have needed to follow a thread if he could just follow the certain path, right? So it's confusing, but it's also very neat because this is something that's been studied a lot. It's really old. People have been living in Knossos since 8,000 BC. There's evidence of settlement super far back, partly because of natural caves and things like that, places to live, and it's just a good spot to be. I want to plug the book, The Bull from the Sea by Mary Renault, one of my favorite historical fiction authors. She had two books. This is the sequel to The King Must Die. It's a historical fiction based on Theseus. It's from Theseus's point of view, which is really neat. Like, super old historical fiction. That's hard to pull off. She does it, like I said, she does a wonderful job of it. One of my favorite authors. And it depicts Knossos and the idea of the Minotaur. It's not actually a Minotaur. It's a general named Minos who wears a bald-headed helmet. And people are, you know, it's just, that's how the story, she just supposes that's how the story became over time. People thought of him, oh, he was a bull. Or an actual Minotaur. No, he was just a nasty man with a bull head. Or he's like a Gendry. Or the Gendry.
I always assumed that the Minotaur was symbolic of something, that it wasn't actually a half-man, half-bull thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like the centaurs, maybe, or just people riding horses, maybe. A similar idea, right? Like, you can see how that would be mistaken. But here's where it gets even more interesting. The double-headed axe is a really important symbol here. And you're going to
see... To clarify, you're now talking about actual history, not this book.
Yes. Still talking right, about actual history, yeah. There's been double-headed axes found all over Knossos and other places. So keep that in mind as we move forward, because the double-headed axe is also like horns. You can see that as the bullhead's horns. This is a symbol that way as well. So then keep that in mind as we go through this next couple of points here. There's these stone labyrinths of Bolshoi-Zayatsky Island. There's 13 or 14 of them. All these labyrinths are in a relatively small area, and there's another huge stone complex elsewhere on the island without any labyrinths. So there's like a less than a square, half square kilometer where there's 13 or 14 of these labyrinths on this really remote area in the White Sea, the Sovoletsky Islands. This is, if you're in Finland and go due east into Russia, and then you go into the water, that's where the White Sea is. The thing about these is, unlike Knossos, they haven't been studied. There hasn't been like a lot of archaeology or people sent there to do deep study on it. So it's really unknown. But these are the true labyrinths where there's one pass. Right, they're not a maze. And they are not very big. 25 meters is like square is like the biggest one. So that's still pretty big for, you know, Stone Age constructions. They had to move all these large stones around. But they're not like massive complexes, temple complexes. But they're just great, interesting old mystery. Like, who built them? Why? What's the deal? Definitely there's echoes of death within them. The transition to the next world is what a lot of people think it is. But no one knows for sure. Now here, let's look at a comparison with Lorath. Here's a quote about the mazes, or at least the first quote about the mazes. We've got several maze quotes, so here's the first one.
Sprawling constructs of bewildering complexity, made from blocks of hewn stone, the maze maker's constructions are scattered across the isles, and one, badly overgrown and sunk deep into the earth, has been found on Essos proper, on the peninsula south of Lorath. Lorathian, the second largest of the Lorath Isles, is home to a vast maze that fills more than 3/4 of the surface area of the island and includes 4 levels beneath the ground, with some passages descending 500 feet.
Yeah, that is massive, right? Like, I just described this really crazy, creepy thing on the White Sea where there's a bunch of labyrinths in a really small area. That one tiny corner of an island had 13 or 14 labyrinths. This is like the opposite of that, where the labyrinths occupy 3/4 of the island instead of just one corner of it taking all of it. It's the opposite, where only one corner of this island doesn't have a labyrinth on it. And it goes 500 feet down. These ones on Sovoletsky Islands don't go down at all. They're all completely on the surface. So yeah, this is wild. This is really intense and imposing and amazing and super, super cool. So think about this. If you have a similar like attitude, spiritual attitude towards this symbolism of mazes and enlightenment, it might be why people came here later. They're like, oh, these big mazes there. That sounds like a place for us to go to seek enlightenment. Later, we'll find out that the worshipers of the blind god Boash or Bosh, or I don't know how to say that, chose this location to colonize for their believers only. They were one of these Valyrian sects that left to found their own spot where there weren't a lot of other religions around. Perhaps the maze makers were also that within their own people, right? They were some lost race, but that doesn't mean the race was the maze makers, right? They could have been 1% of a larger race that 99% of them didn't build mazes, but the other 99% built other things. It's weird for me that to think that an entire culture were all involved in building these mazes. Weren't there people doing other stuff? Nope. All we do is build mazes. Like, interesting to think about that. This is an offshoot of a larger race, and larger, literally larger, because they were bigger than humans. But
you know, I could see it being like a focus of their culture. Just think of the effort that it would have taken for the pyramids to be built, or even Stonehenge.
Yeah,
it took a long time.
You're right.
Yeah, Stonehenge seemed to be something that people from around the country met together to work on periodically. Mm. And I wonder if maybe the mazes. I also started thinking like 500 feet deep. That's getting to preposterous levels. You know what I mean? That's like taking like modern technology, unless that maybe that it was already there. Maybe shafts were there that they built on,
sure,
like
yeah.
Castle Rock or something. But I also started wondering, what if they were like, I mean, I'm just completely speculating here, but what if there were gold mines and the mazes were meant to make it more difficult to get the gold out? You had they wanted to keep it home, or the material they dug out to get to gold or diamonds, whatever underneath, is what got built into the mazes, which maybe also makes it harder for someone to get in.
Yeah,
maybe. You know, maybe it had some semi-practical purpose for defense, or even sort of like we've said, maybe spiritual. The idea that like you can't just take the gold and run; you got to carry this heavy gold through this long maze. You got to really be determined to leave your island or your home or whatever.
If you can't find the right path, then you're not meant to find the right path. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he found the way there. The gods must have intended that, or something like that.
Or even if you can find it, it still isn't quick and easy and straight.
Yeah.
You know, maybe also easier to stop you along the way if there's a bunch of turns and twists.
Yeah. On the other hand, that might be the point. Might be the lack of resource. It might be like, hey, we want to go somewhere where people aren't going to fight over wealth. We want to be ascetics. We want to have low wealth. We want to be like the monk, like keeping Iceland in mind. Before any Scandinavian people settled there, Iceland was called Thule. And it was just a place where like Christian monks would go to be super isolated. That was vaguely portrayed on the show Vikings when Floki finds like a single cross from a presumably Icelandic Christian monk that came over during the warm season.
I was going to point that out as another parallel, because later on we talk about how eventually Lorath is repopulated after devastation by a religious sect. And Iceland also at one point was populated by a religious sect. That's another parallel to Iceland.
And they could pick it. It would be a place to be one with nature, to be away from the world. That's a plus for some people. Like if you want to be a hermit or you want to be away from all the wars and society, that sounds appealing to go to a place like that.
You know, another thought I had about a potential reason or use for the mazes, both here and in the real world, is there's another place where we have labyrinths of sorts that are actually pretty common. Museums. Museums usually have sort of like winding back and forth, pretty much singular paths. And it's to use the area in a contained space to create more surface for display. I wonder if they had artwork or something along that lines, along the path that was part of their culture.
A more mundane version of that is just a queue, a line queue, where they make it go wind back and forth so that you have an airport or something like that. So it's just an efficient use of space where people just aren't amassed around. That's more straightforward. You're definitely going to one place. You're going on a journey and you're all, it's not very spiritual, but it's not very enlightening, but it's definitely has the structure to it.
And that takes some enlightenment to be patient with it.
That's true. You got to find that inner patience. Where's my calm? Yes. Zen. Get that. Got to have that podcast on in your ears to help you get through it. But also with the lack of wealth means that they're less likely to be bothered from without. Like people aren't going to come invade them to take wealth that isn't there. Right? Let's not, like Drogo. Drogo wasn't interested in Lorath because what's for him there? That sounds like a plus. The Dothraki aren't interested. Sounds good to me. Yes, that is a plus. Like that's better than any big wall you could build. Is just they don't want to come. That's more powerful than any wall. If your religion demands like isolation or alone time, this building a maze and putting yourself in the center of it, that would make you even more isolated. I mean, it does. It's hard to put yourself in that mindset to be like, what if I wanted to be that alone and isolated? This does seem like that would be appealing, though. That said, given there will be a variety of different peoples here, it's not like the place doesn't have an extremely bloody history. It's just that the struggles tend to be more about race and culture than about wealth. People aren't coming to loot it. They're coming just to take it or to struggle over, you know, dogmatic things. So here's another quote as we try to figure out what they were doing with all these mazes.
Before I read this quote, I would like to mention that Aziz has never done a maze. He's never done a corn maze. And I think this fall I need to take him to go do a maze.
No, I've lived in the South and Ohio places that are full of cornfields. Maize. Ah, you call it corn. Yes.
Maize.
Yes.
But yeah.
I don't think I have either, by
really,
the way.
Really, Sean? Well,
if,
maybe.
I'm thinking about it. I can't remember ever being in one.
You're going to come visit this fall and we're all going to go get lost.
I think I did a really small one. Now that, you know, thinking about it more, but nothing that, it wasn't memorable enough.
No, dude, we got to do a really big one. Yeah, we got to find like one of the largest.
The world's biggest corn maze.
Yeah, that would be great. I would love that. I think they're great. Anyways, here's the quote. Scholars still debate the purpose of these mazes. Were they fortifications, temples, towns, or did they serve some other, stranger purpose? The maze makers left no written records, so we shall never know. Their bones tell us that they were massively built and larger than men, though not so large as giants. Some have suggested that mayhaps the maze makers were born of interbreeding between human men and giant women. We do not know why they disappeared, though Lorathi legend suggests they were destroyed by an enemy from the sea. Merlings in some versions of the tale, Selkies and walrus men in others.
So that last sentence is why I told you to keep those seals and walruses in mind, walri in mind, because Selkies are seal people, walrus men, that's self-explanatory. So some idea that these sea enemies destroyed them. There's tales like that in other places, like the Thousand Islands and, you know, in the Whispers, plays discussion of sea creatures like not just Merlings, but the old ones or the deep ones rather, and the Squishers. Yeah, the Squishers, right. My guess is as far as the mazes for the maze makers, my personal guess is that it's this categorization thing, this sorting, like a sorting hat. This their version of Harry Potter's sorting hat. But a religious version rather than a like a school version, as in God tells you what path you should be on. You go into the maze, you go where you go, and the priests interpret your path as something about you. This determines your path in life or what kind of person you are. If you go the right way, quote unquote right way, that says something about you. Maybe there would be like some cheating where rich dad tells his kid, you know, take the one on the left and that'll get you into the priesthood, which is, yeah, that's where you want to be. I imagine there would have been cheating and things like that. But is it like a way to create hierarchy within society? Something like that. A way to put people above other people, which is something that all societies tend to do. So that's neat. What do you think about this, Sean? What do you have thoughts on what you might think they're for or just any general ideas here?
I think that's a neat idea, but I don't know. I didn't go as cynical with it as you. It just might be that, you know, if you go this path, then you're going to be a stonemason. If you go this path, then you're going to be a painter. If you go this path, then you're going to be a farmer. You know, not necessarily putting someone over another, but just finding your trade, if you will.
I like your first two trades you mentioned seemed very Lorathi. Painting and stonemasoning. They definitely seemed ones.
You're another fisherman. Yep, you, fisherman.
Especially if one path came out on the coast. Okay, you're a fisherman.
Yeah,
one
right.
You're like, in a field, you're a farmer. One path goes down into a mine. Okay, you're going to...
I really love that idea. It sounds kind of neat.
It'd be a way to make people think that the gods had chosen it rather than people. Like, the mankind didn't choose this role for you. The heavens chose it for you. And that would make it more like a more rigid society because people wouldn't move out of their God-chosen roles if they truly believed that's what it was.
Beyond that, you chose it for yourself too.
You
right?
did.
You took that path. You went
maybe
there.
Something, you know, like, maybe some subconscious to it, you know?
Especially if along the way there were, whether it was meant to be or coincidental or cheats or whatever, but if there was, you get to a path and there's a painting of a fish on the right and a painting of wheat on the left and you go left and, you know, that might... I can easily see them using it to direct people where they want them to go. Like, we know that our society is short on farmers right now. Okay, like, wall off the path. Wall off the right turn.
Put a little
this
sweet
year.
Smell on this one. They're like, oh, that's
a trail of food.
It's like some baking bread.
You can see all kinds of ways that it could be manipulated in cynical or appropriate ways, you know. But I still think that I'm still going back with the 500-foot shafts. I think that there was a mine. I think there was some sort of value in the earth that they were digging out and wanted to make it more difficult to escape with it or for it to be discovered by outsiders.
Yeah, it could be. It really could be.
It could also be all those other things we said. Yeah, the value, the wealth might have been used up or lost and forgotten.
Sure. Yeah. So it's like a myth convergence. You have Merlings and Selkies and walrus men and giants who bred with humans or some other different race entirely. Maybe they're like halfway between giants and humans. So a lot of stuff converging in this very out of the way remote location, and that makes it extra cool. Nina says, in her mind, the myths of Merlings or Merling-like creatures come up too often in this universe to be simply coincidental or unimportant to the narrative. More to the point, antagonistic creatures from the sea aren't unique to Lorath. Cracklaw points, Legends of Squishers, or that the fish-headed gods worship on the Thousand Islands, the deep ones theorized on by Maester Theron, Ironborn's own claims to literally descend from sea people themselves. So it's pretty believable that not only what the Lorath myths say is true about being destroyed by sea people, but also that the mazes were built as a way to keep them out, to keep the sea people from penetrating deep into their territory. They emerge from deep. The sea and attack.
The deep ones.
The deep ones, yeah. The steep ones. The steep ones. And if they're only, let's say they can only stay out of water for a certain amount of time. Anything that would delay them would be good. Anything that lowers that.
Yeah, I like that.
Shortens their length of time out of... Because those Thousand Islands are only like a jaunt east. You know, they're not close, but they're on the same, along the same coastline. And then you go south. Yeah, I mean, they're everywhere. These myths exist. The Iron Isles are pretty damn far away. And they have similar legends, at least vaguely similar. So yeah, it sounds like there are creatures beneath the sea in Martin's world. Yes, and the idea of the mazes being a way to slow them down. Like the regular people know the mazes... The sea peoples don't. So yeah, it kind of like what you're saying, Sean. They're not protecting mineral wealth necessarily. They're just, it'd be hard to get in and out quickly. And that's the point. You wouldn't be able to, the thing that's being stolen maybe is humans. But it could be yeah. Wealth. Like it would work for either, you know? We definitely have confirmation that people lived in the mazes. We don't know that the maze makers did, but definitely humans came along and did that. But that's not all though. Within this topic... is a theorized link to the so-called strange stone. Let's have a quote in that regard.
The labyrinthine nature of its interior architecture has led Archmaester Killian to suggest that the fortress might have been the work of the mazemakers, a mysterious people who left remnants of their vanished civilization upon Lorath and the Shivering Sea. The notion is intriguing, but raises more questions than it answers. What is this structure talking about? I remember this.
The
tower
base of the High Tower. The strange stone base of the High
Tower, yeah.
Which has like, it's a little bit labyrinthine on the inside, yeah. I don't think the evidence holds up super well. For one reason, there is no strange stone on Lorath that we know of. There's mazes.
Yeah.
How can we possibly feel confident that the Archmaesters who are in the dark, the farther east you go, the less they seem to know about what they're talking about. I don't have confidence that they know Lorath really well, right? So it's definitely possible. You definitely can't close that door.
I don't have confidence that people in Lorath know Lorath very well, right?
Yeah.
The interiors of those mazes could easily have those
secret doors,
weird like black stones and passages yet to be discovered. Yeah. Or being kept secret that even if they have been discovered.
Yeah, there's so much potential for hidden rooms or just unknown stuff in there. It like Casterly Rock. We talked about the hidden tunnel in Gibraltar with the Nazi stay behind tunnel thing. Like that wasn't discovered for a long time. And that's with modern technology and people knowing that it was there to look for. Here, nothing like that, but not that we know of. So that's really neat. Who knows what the Archmaesters are in the dark about? Yeah, quite literally in this case. Yes. All right, let's do some questions here and then get back to it. Pulled pork sandwiches. The pattern could also be a Roger Zelazny reference to the Amber series. Yes, actually, I have seen that theorized before. The pattern is a phrase he uses a lot in those books. And George R. R. Martin is absolutely a fan of the Nine Princes in Amber series by Roger Zelazny. I think maybe I've told this story before, but it's so fun and quick that I'll tell it again. I was hanging out with one of George's assistants in Santa Fe. And we go to his bookstore, George's bookstore, which is right next to his movie theater. They're directly next to each other. And there are two people working behind the counter there. And we're chatting with them, you know. They're all friends. I'm new to this group, but they're all friends. They've known each other. She had used to work at the bookstore before she worked directly for George. And when we leave, she's like, those are Roger Zelazny's kids. And I was like, what? I was like, what? Really? Roger Zelazny's kids work at George R. R. Martin's bookstore. That's right. Yes. Small world.
You know, there's a role-playing game. I think it's called Amber, based on this world.
Yeah.
And it has... I haven't read these books, so I'm not super familiar, but I think the world of this role-playing game is set in this world. But it also has some unique role-playing dynamics. For example, they don't use dice.
Oh.
They rely a little bit more on just, I don't know how to say this, like the experience and intuition of the players just to do what makes sense. Does that make sense? It's a little more role-playing based than like random chance-based. I think there's some other system for that. It might be like a bidding system for how you get your basic stats. Rather than roll a die and see you have a high strength, everyone makes, you have like points and you bid points to see who gets highest, lowest, middle strength, or whatever.
It's kind of like in the Game of Thrones board game. Where you bid your points.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, there's no dice in that either. Yeah, the Zelazny, this Amber world is sort of multiversey, or maybe multidimensional might be a better way to put it. But yeah, there's like world, there's going to different dimensions and worlds, and like these different Amber princes rule their own dimensions and start fighting each other. It's pretty epic. I read it a long time ago. I don't remember it super well. I read it in like the 90s. Christina K says, sometimes certain like religious or cultural groups will walk mazes on the ground as a way to meditate. Yeah.
And then I brought up the show Foundation, which had a whole big arc where Lee Pace's emperor character goes to this religious planet and walks the maze. And it was
that's right.
Really well done.
I can't believe I didn't think of that. That's a great example. Yeah, really good.
The show itself, I'm like, if you like sci-fi, it's a fine show. I want to be on record that I don't think it's an amazing show. I think it does some things very well and some things very poorly.
It's got multiple plot lines. Some of the plot lines aren't that good, and some of them are. It's just that simple. Anyway,
that's my disclaimer. If you watch Foundation after me bringing this up,
it's almost better than you
blame me.
View it as a separate project from the books, because like the Foundation books have always been viewed as unadaptable, and I'm not sure that this changes that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Yeah, some of the stuff they made up it wasn't in the books, is some of the best stuff, which is, it's weird. The adaptation part failed, but their own endeavor worked out. So whatever. Anyway, moving on. Terra Incognita says, Walrus Men and Maze Makers, the Walrus and the Carpenter. All right. Nice. Christina K. also said, this is from an earlier comment on Discord, technology advances, but cultures and societies don't, and definitely not in a linear fashion. Instead, they adapt to their circumstances and environment. Just like city folk are confused in the country and country folk are confused in the city, neither is more advanced than the other. They're just used to different things. It's a great point. Like, we don't build monolithic structures anymore, she says. Is that progress? Or the opposite, or neither. It's neither. It's just we value what we value. We don't care about building that, so we don't do it. If we started caring about it, that wouldn't make us better to our ancestors or inferior to them or whatever. It would just mean we care about different stuff. Another way you could look at it is who did more with less. Yeah, these civilizations did great things, but they had it easy. They had technology given to them by other beings. Like, on the other hand, like Stonehenge, well, that was clever. They didn't have technology, you know? So things can be impressive now versus impressive then, based on how much work it was, how much creativity. And it's not always as simple as just older is less advanced and now is more advanced, right? Even if we're taller now, that doesn't mean we're smarter or wiser. We haven't walked the path of wisdom necessarily.
It's relative, you know, among many other factors, it's relative. Like if someone wanted to build Stonehenge now, it'd be pretty easy with modern technology. But if someone wanted to build just a basic house 2,000 years ago, it would have been, you know, like the best technology in the world would not make a house, an average house that we have in modern times.
Yeah, so it's an important point to remember. Lots of cultures are going to adapt to living in the strange environs of Lorath and the Mazemakers that was created well before them. That's a somewhat of a unique thing, is to come move into an empty place where people spent thousands of years building it before it was left empty. And that's just amazing. Like one of the better modern examples I can think of is these empty Chinese cities, right? The ones that were pre-built that almost no one lives in them. It's like that, where you just stumble upon a pre-built metropolis. Whoa, no one lives here. It's got street lights, buildings. I mean, in some cases, a few people live there. You've got like a town designed for 4 million people that has like 50,000 people in it. So it's not entirely abandoned, but it's got that feel to it. And this, I imagine like a few settlers move to Lorath after the Mazemakers are gone, or after the Hairy Men are gone or whatever, which we're going to get to all the different people that live there. It would be just awe-inspiring. You're like, no one lives here? This is empty? Whoa. I mean, that would just be, I can't even imagine the depths of emotion and just awe I would feel in such a place.
You might even think it was amazing.
Oh, it's pretty good.
I can't believe I beat you to that.
Pretty good. A couple of real quick facts from Wikipedia. Largest indoor maze in the world is in Dubai at the Gardens Shopping Mall. The largest period is in Samsø, Denmark. It's 60,000 square meters. The UK loves mazes most of all, as I said. There's three examples. The Cliveden House was originally laid out in 1894, restored in 2011. It's got 1,100 yew trees. The public can go there. Chatsworth House Garden Maze has 1,209 yew trees. So these are yew mazes. That's pretty cool. These yew mazes are for me and you.
Is it Cliveden or is it Cliveden?
I have no idea.
Okay, I'm going to say
it could be Cliveden. Yeah,
I don't know. I'm just curious. I had to know if it was some like weird British pronunciation that you knew and I didn't.
Take my word for it. I'm pretty sure it's Chatsworth.
Yeah, that one seems pretty straightforward.
And then I'm pretty sure this next one is called York Maze. I don't know of another way to say York, but this one is located near RAF, which is that Royal Air Force, Elvington, and constructed using maize. It is a maize, you know, maize meaning corn. And it's specifically Dalek corn, D-A-L-E-K. Yes, spelled like Doctor Who.
Like the Daleks.
In fact, this maze was built to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who.
Oh, wow.
It is a Doctor Who maze. Made from Dalek corn. That's surprise. That was a surprising thing to run into in Wikipedia. Like, wait, what? Also, just amazing, right? 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. That show has been around a damn long time. 50th.
Yeah, it's evolved a lot, but that's definitely multiple generations of a show.
Guilty Undertaker says, not surprising that Harry Potter includes a maze then. And that's true. The fourth book, one of the main parts of it is this maze at the end of the Triwizard Tournament. And you're right, it must be a very British thing to have mazes.
Yeah. Like basically, go to Wikipedia and look at the entry on mazes, and it's got examples of real mazes in the world, but just there's just a lot of them. UK clearly has the most based on that listing. Spain was next, I think. But there could be lots of others that just weren't written there. Like maybe some of the Chinese ones just weren't in Wikipedia because English speakers didn't put it there. I don't know.
I Googled this just now. I looked up biggest maze in Georgia. And I see that here in Georgia, we have Uncle Shuck's corn maze. Someone says it took them 35 minutes to traverse it, but I'm good at mazes.
That's pretty long.
So that's someone who's good at mazes. Mm. It's the largest corn maze in Georgia, and we're going.
Interesting. All right.
It might take us 35 days. 35 days in the maze.
So yeah, we don't know much about the maze-making people. As it said, they're large, but not as large as giants. We don't really know if they were hairy like the giants are. If they were, then it would even more strongly imply some sort of evolutionary connection, maybe an offshoot, given that they're in between the size of humans and giants. That could be a clue, especially because people and giants, there's been talk of that being a thing that can happen. Hodor having giant's blood or Umbers having giant's blood gets talked about in somewhat jokingly, but partly serious. So the next people that moved there were apparently the hairy men. Here's a quote.
Others followed the maze makers on Lorath in the centuries that followed. For a time, the Isles were home to a small, dark, hairy people akin to the men of Ib. Fisherfolk, they lived along the coasts and shunned the great mazes of their predecessors.
So that's interesting. That's unique, I think. Lots of people are going to live on these Isles, but only these Ibanese or these cousins of the Ibanese. They're not proper Ibanese, I suppose. I suppose they're cousins. Shun the mazes. All the humans who take...
Could you say they're Ibish?
Yeah, they are Ibish. That's good. Well, the humans who moved to the island seem to universally live in the mazes. They're like, yeah, let's use these. Let's take these over. Maybe they don't use all of them, but in general, they're like, yeah, this is existing construction. Let's make use of that. So it sounds like the Ibanese, maybe they should have, or these hairy men should have, because they're going to get slaughtered. And if the mazes were used for defense, well, maybe they should have repurposed it just for that. We do talk a little more about these hairy men in our giants episode with Amanda Crowfoot's daughter. They are larger than the Ibanese, smaller than the Giants, etc. And we also mentioned them in the Sarnor episode. Remember the legendary High King Huzor Amai skinned the king of the hairy men or something and wore it as a pelt, which we were like, that's pretty grim, man. Like, how humanoid were these guys? Because that's Bolton stuff, man. You know?
It's just kind of gross.
It is just gross, yeah. I guess it's, if you see them as pure animal, it's not that different than wearing a lion pelt, I guess. And it's not like they have textiles to wear back then. You got to wear something. I don't know. The same story ends up happening, just like the Huzor Amai slaughtering hairy men. The hairy men of Lorath couldn't hold on. I'm sure they didn't call it Lorath, but they couldn't hold on to it. That's why I was throwing shade on them for not using the mazes. Maybe they should have used the mazes, but it's the same reason the first men couldn't hold on to Westeros. It was those pesky Andals coming in their great numbers with their iron weapons and their blonde hair and their blue eyes and all that, you know, and their seven-pointed stars. But first, super chat from our good friend TKOK Podcast Network saying, Vargo Ho talking about all the cool stuff he did in Lorath and everyone thinking he banged Loras.
Like, Lorath is so beautiful. I'm like, wow, he really loves Loras. Okay.
Because of, that's a, yes, the good one. Yeah. Comes out better in the audiobook when Vargo Hoat's speeches. Let's talk about the Andals. Here's a quote.
They in turn were displaced by Andals, pushing from North Andalos to the shores of Lorath Bay and across the bay in longships. Clad in mail and wielding iron swords and axes, the Andals swept across the islands, slaughtering the hairy men in the name of their seven-faced god and taking their women and children as slaves.
That was the general pattern in the region for the Andals and the hairy men. They were slowly pushed back towards Ib, and Ib is pretty much the only place they exist now, with a few exceptions. Obviously, they get around. They're traders and sail all over the world, but as far as home bases, that's the majority of it's there. This bit about slavery, though, that's a little unusual. We don't really hear about that before. The Andals enslaving the hairy men, I don't recall seeing that elsewhere. And you wonder how that can even be allowed. Maybe anti-slavery aspect of Andal culture came along later, or the same reason they can wear a pelt of a something and not think of that as like wearing the skin of a human, because their loophole might be that it's illegal to enslave other people. And if they don't think of the hairy men as people, then to them it doesn't count. Which, that comes up throughout the history of slavery in the real world. Just dehumanizing someone or saying, oh, they're not really human, they're lesser, in order to say it's okay to enslave them. So the same sort of energy is present here, I think.
I mean, I guess I feel like the Valyrians could have had similar thoughts too. Just like,
oh, yeah,
everyone that wasn't a Valyrian was fine to enslave.
Totally agree with you there.
And we see that with the Targaryen exceptionalism too come up to play in Westeros. This idea of like, we're, you know, separate species.
Better. Yeah. And sadly, they had very distinct things they could point to sort of back that argument up, which got a lot of people to buy into it. Like, hey, we can ride dragons. You can't. We've got disease resistance. You don't. We resist heat better. You can't. Like,
I mean, not going to lie, if someone comes up to me in the real world and shows me all of that evidence, I'd be like, yeah, I think you're probably a better specimen than I am.
Yeah, I would prefer your genetics to mine. Yes.
It still doesn't mean I want them to enslave me, or I think it's justifiable.
Absolutely.
Like, I think if your genetics are really superior, you should be able to see that. I think that would be part of being superior is recognizing slavery is wrong, you know?
Yep. Totally agree with that, too. We're making some good points here, my friends. So you can really see how the mazes could be used as well to indicate hierarchy. These mazes could enforce that. Like, the closer to the center of the maze you live in, the higher up you are, the closer you are to the center of the godhood or the center of whatever, the center of what's important, however they see it, whatever the religious significance is of these specific people, whatever the Andals of that time felt. Right? The labyrinths are often symbols of journey towards enlightenment. So the closer to the center you live, the closer it's saying that you are more enlightened or that you are closer to God, right? It says that in a societal manner. So it's a fascinating combination of elements here. You got worshipers of the seven living in these huge mazes. It's not what you picture when you think of septs. It's very different. Like, they aren't building, they're maybe building septs within the mazes or decorating it, adorning it with iconography of the seven. But still going to be in this old mazy thing built by someone long ago. And that's just very different than picturing like the Sept of Remembrance or the Rhaenys' High Hill, the churches in Westeros and things like that. It's just so different. This very odd like combination of worlds colliding that's really neat. I really hope we get to see it on TV at some point. They could really go off with the imagination. Nina also says, I also wonder what these Andals thought of the pre-Westerosi Andals' belief that Westeros was their promised land. Since clearly they didn't join them in going to Westeros, right? That's a great point. Westeros is where they eventually all went, obviously fleeing the Valyrians. Was this a religious sect of the faith that branched off, meaning this group? Or was the other group that went to Westeros, were they more of a sect, just a large one? What's the relationship between these two groups? We also don't know when this happened. I think this was later. I think these are Andals that stuck around that didn't go to Westeros, because I think pretty sure the Westerosi Andals happened before this, but I definitely don't know for sure. Definitely don't know for sure. Maybe another theory from Nina that I like a lot, maybe there are multiple competing ideas on where the Promised Land was. They're fleeing from the Valyrian expansion. The Valyrians are subsuming them, conquering them, enslaving them. A lot of people are fleeing to new lands. Some of that would be rooted in religion. Like, where's the new Promised Land? We see the same thing with Nymeria and her people, right? Where's the new Promised Land? Some of them were convinced that it was Westeros. Some of them were convinced that it was Lorath. We get lost deep in the mazes. The dragons can't find us down in there. The dragons don't like Westeros. Let's go there. They've already shown they don't like going there. It's a place we can be free of them. There's good arguments for both of these. You got to make your choice. The maze, their maze journey forked there. That was their decision.
I can imagine there's a reason why this group of Andals ended up in this spot and others ended up in Westeros if this group believed in slavery. Like maybe they're like...
Oh, that could be a...
Were different factions, you know?
Very good point, Sean. Very good point. Yeah, that is a distinct potential difference there. You're right. I like that idea. It could also just be regional. Like these could be the ones that lived closer to Lorath and had heard about it. I mean, the Andals were not confined only to the Axe. They were all over northern Essos, northwestern Essos, I suppose. And the pushing back by the Valyrians was a very gradual thing. You know, it wasn't something that happened just within one generation. It happened across potentially hundreds of years.
Same thing if you think about Europeans coming across to America. There were different groups of Europeans at different time periods. In fact, Greenland, with a faction of people left Iceland to settle Greenland, you know?
Yeah, you're right. And we've made that point over and over with the First Men. We only think of the First Men as the First Men because we don't know how to divide them into separate groups. That we know they had to have had separate groups. They couldn't have all just been one monolithic body. And it's the same with the Andals. They may have closer relationship culturally to each other. There still would be plenty of divisions, cultural and otherwise, based on geography and background and subcultures, things like that.
I mean, not to beat a dead horse, but even if at one point the Andals were this single monolithic group that were of a mind and religion, it was all the same, and a group of them came across to Westeros. 100 years later, that same group that was monolithic before has probably evolved, split into new different factions, and those people then also come across.
Oh.
And does that make sense? Like, even if at one time they were, over time, they keep coming across. They don't stay the exact same monolith over time, even if they were at one point. They probably even weren't at one point in the first place, but...
That's neat. So here's another curious real-world connection that's also a possible connection in Planetos. So think about what we've been saying with regards to the Andals, with axes, and then go back to our earlier discussion on labyrinths. The word labyrinth might, in part, derive from the word labris, which means double-headed axe. So a labyrinth could translate as house of the double-headed axe. And a double-headed axe could also very easily be seen as horns, as I talked about before, which brings up those Minotaur vibes. That look is going to be true in fantasy as much as it is on Earth. Double axes are all over this ancient Minoan religion. The Minoan religion was the one present on Crete, on Knossos, in this time of Theseus and before that. But it wasn't a weapon. A lot of traditions hold that it wasn't a weapon. It was a divine feminine symbol. And for example, in that book I was talking about, The Bull from the Sea, and this has been found, this is real. They found a throne-like spot with a bathtub in front of it and like big altar behind it and all this other stuff. So it sort of looked like a throne room, but eventually people were like, no, this isn't a throne room. This is like a religious like altar, because the throne looked like it was for a woman. It was small enough, like the impressions were like woman butt sized. And it was somewhat common for women, especially, to dress up like a goddess and to act like they're the avatar of that goddess. She would sit on this throne dedicated to a specific goddess and then act out these rituals. And there'd be like purification. That's what the bath would be for. There's some sort of like baptism type thing going on. So coming back to this, the relation here between axes and labyrinths and mazes is that the Andals come from the axe. And in the world of Ice and Fire, there's a lot of speculation by Archmaesters that the double-bladed axe was their original symbol that was eventually supplanted by the seven-pointed star. And very nearby is very religious Norvos, which still has the double-bladed axe as their chief symbol. Think of Ariohotah and how much he sleeps with his axe, calls it his wife. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And other Archmaesters argue that Andals founded Norvos, which would fit perfectly, like double-bladed axe. It eventually turns into this Norvossi belief. It goes in this direction. Lots of time has passed, so they've become pretty separate and distinct. And all these connections are supported by sheer proximity, right? All these things are really close together. Norvos is right there. Lorath is right there, et cetera. They're all pretty close to each other. That is very rich vein of potential ancient connections there. I like that a lot.
That's interesting. Guilty Undertaker brought up something that I was thinking of too, which was that's probably why some lesbians use the double-headed axe as a symbol. And that is a thing. There's flags, there's lesbian flags and stuff like that that reference the axe, the double axe.
So it goes back to that. So, as a feminine double-bladed axe
symbol. Yes. That's probably what they're referencing in that.
That's pretty cool. It makes sense when you hear it because if it's a feminine symbol and it's two-headed, like two the same, like mirror images. Yeah like
it's often called the labrys.
Yeah.
I was sorry, but yeah, I was like, okay.
Oh, I see. Yes. A labyrinth.
Oh, man. Gosh,
that's why men can't find the notes. Okay. Also back then, in this time we're talking about with Norvos and the axe and the Andals and all that, remember, there'd be no Braavos back then. Braavos is more relatively recent. But there would have been a kingdom of Sarnor, and all the cities of the Rhoyne would have been there. So that's just think about who else was around in that era they would have been trading with, interacting with, having negotiations with here and there. The Andals, though, in their own time, before being ejected by Valyria or during the push of Valyria, spread out around this area. The different islands we talked about were all taken by Andals. At one point, there were just like a dozen kings. Four of them on Lorath proper. Another one on Lorassion. Another one on each of these little islands, like the Ironborn, a little bit like that, where each like rock kings and all that. Roughly 1,000 years of this state of affairs. Supposedly in this era also, the Lorathi contested the Ibanese over Bitterweed Bay. We talked about that in the Kingdom of Sarnor episode as well, the one that has like a bajillion ships sunk beneath the waters there. Lots of battles have fought there. That's probably this era when this happened. Because it seems like the Lorathi expansion was at its greatest during the time that they were Andals. They were ruled by the Andals. And eventually an Andal king called Carlon the Great, another George R. Martin special with a name that starts with Q and doesn't have a U after it. But it's Carl, you got a lot of those. So he conquered an area around Lorath that included what would eventually be Braavos and all the coastline in between and started to move south towards Norvos. He built his base on Lorassion. He had a wooden keep in the center of the huge maze in Lorassion for which he gave orders and sent troops out. It sounds pretty fascinating, like a really unique kingship where just the king in the maze. What kind of a clever name would George come up with that? The king of the labyrinth, the king in the, I don't know. That's just,
it's obviously the goblin king.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The labyrinth is Jareth.
Yeah, of course. That's a great call. Yes. They would, instead of king, they would be called the Bowie. And they would wield the ceremonial Bowie knife. But this whole...
The Bowie double-bladed axe.
Yes, gotta have the axe in one on the other hand. Yeah, you're right. This got the attention of Valyria, this incursion, this heading south, this trying to carve out an empire. And that brings us to our next section, which I've called The Doom of Lorath.
It is written in the Fires of the Freehold that 100 dragons took to the skies, following the great river north to descend upon the Andals as they lay siege to Norvos. Carlon the Great burned with his army, and afterward the dragon lords flew onward, bringing blood and fire to the Isles of Lorath. Carlon's great keep went up in flames, as did the towns and fishing villages along his shores. Even the great stones of the mazes were scorched and blackened by the firestorms that swept across the islands. It is said that not a man, woman, or child survived the scouring of Lorath. So hot did those fires burn.
So again, this was before the wars with the Rhoynar. So maybe this sort of gave them the idea of what they could do when they all ganged up on someone. This might be the first time like a lot of dragons all went to one place. Certainly the oldest one I can think of. So this would have been, that would have been about 500 years after this, the attack on the Rhoynar, when all that came together. And that attack on the Rhoynar would have been 1,000 years before current events. So as I said, Carlon's keep was wooden. So that's not great against dragons. However, I do wonder, why were they so brutal to the rest of the Isles? Like, what was the point of that? They're like, yeah, we killed this king. Let's go kill everyone else too. Like, why? Why'd they do that? I guess they were just having fun. I don't know.
Well, they've got to make a big symbol of it.
Yeah, they just wanted to make an example.
You got to make a show, make an example, exactly. And then all the other cities won't do that.
Yeah, that's probably it. Probably something like that. Yeah, just make an example of them. There could have been a commercial reason, like some of these other freeholders. Oh, I'm in the whalebone business and I want to shut down a competitor. But that's maybe less likely because, again, there's just not a lot of big industries here, you know, and I don't know. It's possible, but it's maybe a thinner theory than some other possibilities.
I remember being like, I don't know, disturbed and frustrated by the idea that they burned the armies and then went and burned everyone that lived back in their home. Like the idea that it's maybe a lesson to other people, I think that's bad logic too. Like I could still see that might be a reason they had it. They don't necessarily have a good logic. But the thing is, when you have a tyrant, when you have a warmongering leader, he doesn't care about his people.
He doesn't.
You know what I mean? The fact that his people might face some retribution is not going to, maybe I guess I won't attack because I'm worried about my people. You know, that's not no, the mentality yeah. of tyrants, you know?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And the Valyrians were tyrants too. So I suppose like they just don't care. They're just like, yeah, they don't want to take even the tiniest percent chance of risk here. They're like, we don't care anything for these people. To them, it's a superiority thing. Like it allows them to think of these Andalese commoners as no better than seals and walruses and crabs, like the other beasts that live in this area. So here's the next quote that describes what it was like following the scouring of Lorath, which is the official name. I called it the Doom, but you know, it gets the point across either way. Here's the quote.
Thereafter, the Lorathi Isles remained uninhabited for more than a century. Seals and walrus returned in great numbers, and crabs scuttled through the scorched and silent mazes. Whalers from the port of Ibbin put ashore to mend their holes or find fresh water. But they never ventured inland. The islands were said to be haunted, and the Ibanese believed any man accursed who went beyond the sound of the sea.
So that's back to the same business we saw with the Ibanese before. They're not willing to go in the mazes, which tells me they didn't really check. I mean, we've heard in modern warfare, you cannot capture a city with planes only, right? You bomb it into submission, then you send in the infantry, right? So I'm extremely skeptical that people didn't survive deep down in those mazes. 500 feet down in a maze, how's the dragon fire going to get down there? And it's not rocket science. There's dragons coming down. Get underground. It's the most obvious place to go. So I'm real skeptical that literally everyone was wiped out. I'm guessing some people were there. However, they would potentially be just as reluctant to leave the maze as the Ibanese would to go in them. Because they're like, we don't want the Valyrians to find out we're still here. We do not want them coming back. We want to stay hidden for a long time. They might be very afraid of going back to the surface to alerting anyone that they're there, right? So that might be why history remembers them as being gone, because they were intent on making it known that they were hiding or not letting anyone know that they were there. So I could see that. It just adds up to me logically. But still, it was undoubtedly a catastrophe. I mean, total devastation is probably pretty accurate, or only a small exaggeration at most. An ecological reset. It's not the doom in the sense that the landscape is permanently scarred by magic, but it is another time where, well, people can come back in. You know, anyone who wants to come live here, it's wide open for you. And we saw the Ibanese show up in smaller numbers, but they didn't want to live in the mazes still because of their belief about not staying away from the sound of the sea.
I like that device, by the way. I think that's a really good sort of setup in a fantasy world of having a culture that doesn't believe it. And it's almost like in the real world, seafarers for the longest time didn't want to get out of sight of land, you know? So it allows for this unexplored area, you know, allows for secrets and mysteries, you know?
That's cool. Yeah, you're right. That does fit with the setting really well, the old role-playing idea too. You'd have this area that could have been explored, but because of religious customs, it never was because we just don't do that. And it's a little bit like Braavos, this idea that they could be hiding, because Braavos kept its location secret for a long time before the unmasking of Uthero. But unlike Braavos, you've got people coming to settle there because people know the place exists. They just don't know the people there. And they don't know there's, you know, a location. So when a place is empty for a while, maybe eventually someone's like, you know what? I'm going to go live there. And that happened with the worshipers of the blind god. Quote.
When men at last returned to the Isles to live, there were men from Beleriand itself. 1,322 years before the Doom, a sect of religious dissidents left the freehold to establish a temple upon Loras' main isle.
So this was the year 1,436 BC. You get an unusually precise dating for that. When we discussed Valyria, it came up that some religions, ironically, didn't approve of the freedom of religion that the freehold granted and went elsewhere to a place where no other gods were worshipped. This is an example of that. Nina gives us another real-world example, say the Pilgrims, who first left England, where they disagreed with the mainline Church of England, not for North America, but for Holland, first in Amsterdam and then in Leiden. While the Pilgrims initially appreciated the religious toleration of the Dutch Republic, they eventually left Holland in part because they disagreed with what they saw as lax religious observance of their Dutch fellow Christians, who still, for example, they would work on Sabbath. The Pilgrims would not. That's just one example. So there's definitely plenty of real-world examples where people are like, look, if you're not going to... We only want to be around people who follow our religion like really well. We don't even want to be near others. And a place like this is pretty perfect for people who really want to be isolated. You got this remote, out-of-the-way place that apparently has been scorched into non-existence, just waiting for someone else to go move there. The blind god worshippers are like, that sounds like us. Here's another quote.
These new Larathi were worshippers of Bosch, the blind god. Rejecting all other deities, the followers of Bosch ate no flesh, drank no wine, and walked barefoot through the world, clad only in hair shirts and hides. Their eunuch priests wore eyeless hoods in honor of their god. Only in darkness, they believed, would their third eye open, allowing them to see the higher truths of creation that lay concealed behind the world's illusions. The worshippers of Bosch believed that all life was sacred and eternal, that men and women were equal, that lords and peasants, rich and poor, slave and master, man and beast, were all alike, all equally worthy, all creatures of God.
That last part, you can see why the Valyrians wouldn't approve. The Braavosi would, but again, there were no Braavosi in these days. So they didn't have those friends to agree with them. So I really must question the wisdom of choosing to be blind while also choosing to live in a place full of mazes. You really have to have faith. You won't get lost. I mean, maybe your memory is a facet of Godhead, like your subconscious memory of these paths. And if you can't find the paths, you're not meant to.
Maybe they were truly enlightened. It sounds like it based on their belief system.
Yeah. That's certainly a way they would frame it. Nina says, I wonder whether it was considered more appropriate to worship the blind god in Lorath. If the doctrine of the blind god was that the world was full of illusions and that Bosch's followers had to see past them to reach the truth, then maybe they saw the mazes as a manifestation of these earthly illusions, artificial trickery that they had to navigate to see the truth, and their blindness would only heighten the difficulty, so prove themselves even more worthy of finally reaching the truth. Yeah, it's you're putting another obstacle in the path to this enlightenment, which just makes the journey, the success of that journey, all the more meaningful, all the more triumphant. When you're trying to remove the distractions of the world, your own senses can lie to you. Like we're all seeing things through eyes that aren't the same as the eyes of God. So this is these metaphorical, metaphysical ways to get closer to God by removing the things that take you away from it. Your own senses can fool you and trick you. That's why this quote is written that way, or has that in there, that only in darkness could their third eye open. Nina also says the followers of Bosch may have also looked to Lorath's past both under its prior inhabitants and its scouring by the Valyrians is sort of a clean slate for them as designated by their god. They may have seen that as, look, this path has been made clear for us. This land was given to us. We are the inheritors of it. It's ours. It's all, it's destiny. That's what their faith tells them. So she continues, for people who believed that all men and women were equal, a place that had been cleansed of its past of slavery under the Andals might have seemed like Bosch himself had worked through the Valyrians to prepare it for his followers, to spread his doctrine of equality there. That's pretty nice. I like that. I like that take by Nina there. By the way, anyone who's read Stormlight Archive, are you probably thinking of Mosh here? Bosch and Mosh?
Bosch and Mosh.
I don't know how to say Mosh. It's the same spelling with an M instead of the B.
Oh,
I keep thinking, yeah.
There is a name. I think it's, I want to say it's a Latin name. Boaz. B-O-A-Z. It's Boaz. I know.
Yeah, there is. I know Boaz is like an Israeli name, like a Hebrew name.
Okay. So I have it wrong. Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. So that's really neat. Now, this brings us back to one of the main characters. Here's a quote from Bran, A Clash of Things. Bran, A Clash of Kings 7, which we called the one where Hodor opens the door. This is the last chapter in A Clash of Kings, by the way.
3 days, said Jojen. The boy had come up softfoot, or perhaps he had been there all along. In this blind black world, Bran could not have said.
And then later, a few paragraphs later, there's this line.
Here in the chill, damp darkness of the tomb, his third eye had finally opened.
So, same concepts. Blind black world, down in the darkness in the tombs where Bran was. They had no light down there, and that's enlightenment did come to him. He finally opened his third eye. He reached out to Jon, the three-eyed crow. Three eyes, right? Like straightforward. And that's what he first encountered, that in the blind black world of his coma dream. Lots of similar language here. And the third eye is just, we've been hearing about third eyes through all sorts of metaphysical religions and as a conception long before A Song of Ice and Fire, but it's definitely present here. And so that makes it most relevant for us. Really cool. I like that. This connection seems very rich. Not entirely sure what to do with it, but it goes to show maybe this is what a form of enlightenment in this world looks like. Yeah. It's not just human enlightenment. There's some perhaps a supernatural element to it, which in Bran's case is definitely the case. The worshippers of the blind god, maybe there is something there for them too. Maybe they can tap into a magical energy, perhaps. The magical overlap, grand magical overlap theory that we've been running on for a long time perhaps applies here as well. Having this all come nicely together with this Bran quote is pretty cool, huh, Sean?
Have you used that phrase before, the grand magical overlap?
No.
I like that.
It's GMO. are you pro or anti GMOs? No, I just said made that up on the fly. Yeah, we should use that. The grand magical overlap.
It fits well because that's exactly my mind. I was thinking many times through the course of this, I think of how what in quote unquote reality could be a god or, you know, supernatural force that in different points in time or different cultures has manifested into a certain god or religion, but it's really the one central thing.
Yeah.
This could just be another example of that easily.
I agree. I totally agree. It really hits hard in that sense that this could be the same form of enlightenment, the same sort of third eye, the same purpose behind all that. It's the same relative methods of reaching it. You've got the blind black world, the labyrinthine nature of the tombs versus Blood Raven's Cave, which is also maybe more maze, but still just a lost blind where enlightenment does exist if you are able to tap into it. On the other hand, speaking of the complete opposite non-magic, we've got Varys going to live in a maze built by someone else. Reminds me of Varys mastering the Red Keep on a more mundane level. He shaves his head like a lot of these the ascetes of the Bosch worshippers. There, Varys is known for, he doesn't really drink. He doesn't wear fancy clothing. He does do the perfume and tries to smell nice. But he sleeps on a stone bed, right? He's very, doesn't keep a lot of wealth for himself, at least not that we see. So he's kind of got this, he's got a lot in common with these blind priests without the religious stuff behind it. So that's neat. That might just be more parallel than intentional connection. But it's still pretty cool. And keeping with Varys, well, what's the deal with Varys? He has this like hardcore attitude. He separates himself from these pleasures, but he's still doing evil stuff, especially with these children. You know, he's like, oh, I want to make the world better, but he's doing really dark things to make it happen, cutting the tongues out of kids and using them as slaves. And so this is the parallel here is that these hardcore Bosch worshippers, these blind priests, were really dedicated, but it only took about 4 or 5 generations before they started to get corrupt. You had other people starting to live there who were subservient to them, putting them in a position of power as the heads of the religion started to corrupt them over time. They started to be above other people rather than, which is directly antithetic to their beliefs. You're not supposed to be above people. You're supposed to view everyone as equal, right? That's from the tenets of their religion. And when you're not upholding your beliefs, the things that make people respect you, well, you're not doing the thing that makes people respect you anymore. They're not going to respect you anymore, right? And they be, you, instead of being a source of discipline and enlightenment, you're just demanding like jerks that take your money.
And hypocrites too. I mean, that's not much turns people off more than hypocrisy.
You're right. You're right. And so
like someone who's doing bad things will still have more respect if they own the fact that they're doing bad things. If they, you know, I don't know, for better or worse, if they embrace it rather than are deceitful about it. It's like an extra layer of bad. You
yeah.
know?
I think we're really at that point, at that kind of a point in this, in our real world right now where so many people, we've gotten to the point in our culture where so many people just refuse to admit they're wrong about something that it becomes super refreshing when someone does. And it's like, someone admitted they were wrong. How nice, how refreshing. It's like, really, this should happen more often, man. Like we're all wrong all the time. It's constant that we make mistakes. Yeah, oh, well. Now, we're not trying to solve all society's ills here. We're talking about non-existent societies. But these are real things that happen, whether it's fantasy or reality.
Yeah, power corrupting is a constant theme, like in the world and history and culture and literature, not just in Martin's world and these stories.
Yep.
And the end justifying the means, like thinking about like Varys, many other characters who they at least believe they have some good big goal, but how they get there,
yeah,
they end up doing evil things. And probably the good big goal they have is to stop someone else who had a good big goal but did some evil things to get there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It is really interesting. That's one of the things I really like about A Song of Ice and Fire. I know some people prefer their fantasy stories to have the good guys and bad guys more distinct, who's what. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. And I enjoy that from time to time. But this helps us understand the real world more, having the grayness of that reflects how most people are. Some people are dark gray. Some people are like off white, you know, which is like.
And some people turn gray to white or black to gray.
They're not monolithic. They're not the same their whole life. Yeah, some people turn and change.
And in Martin's world, it's broad and expansive enough that we also have some pretty clear good guys and bad guys, right? There's lots of gray. In the real world, there's mostly gray, but there are Briennes and Joffreys.
You know? Yeah, there certainly are. Those are good examples. Well point. So this blind god cult stuck around for a while, even as it lost power, but it was completely gone by 700 BC. So 700 years before the conquest. And that takes us to our next quote, which gives us pretty much what it's like now, in a manner of speaking. And Ashea is going to read us another quote.
After the fall of blind priests, Lorath became a freehold after the manner of Valyria, ruled over by a council of 3 princes. The Harvest Prince was chosen by a vote of all those who owned land upon the islands, the Fisher Prince by all those who owned ships, the Prince of the Streets by the acclamation of the freemen of the city. Once chosen, each prince served for life. These 3 princes continue to sit today, though the titles have become purely ceremonial. The true authority resides with a council of magisters made up of nobles, priests, and merchants. Its isolation meant that the Lorathi were little involved in the events of the Century of Blood, save for those few who sold their swords to Braavos or Norvos.
Yeah, Lorathi sell swords are definitely a thing. We see a few of those around. Jaqen H'ghar, who is our last topic today, is masquerading as a Lorathi sellsword. The prince's part of 3 princes there is similar to Pentos, except for some pretty big differences in that they serve for a year and are often ritually killed, where in Lorath they serve for life. So it sounds like the princes in Pentos have a lot less power because, well, if you can be killed and only rule for a year, well, how in charge are you really? You know, it's part of the system. But still, just the naming of princes based on basic functions, like the prince of the fields is very similar to the harvest prince. But 3 princes, is that like an advancement on the spin doctor's method of rule there? Yeah, that's what I said now. Nina says, once again, the practice of democracy in this world is limited to select social classes or elites, which was true for much of democracy's history in our world as well. The harvest and fisher princes could only be elected by those with sufficient capital to own ships or land. And the sailors on their ships and the hired laborers or slaves on that land don't get a say on who will be their leaders. Likewise, the prince of the streets was elected by the free men of the city. That's code for letting, including not just slaves, but women, free men of the city, not free people of the city. So probably very similar to Greek democracy, where only the landholding citizens, and citizen meant landholding men. I didn't need to say landholding citizen then, just citizen, landholding men, code for that. So yeah, so citizen is a very differing term depending on what time or place you're speaking of.
This has come up a lot too. I do want to point out, even there is, you know, a hole in these ostensibly democratic systems. It's still better than a tyrant. It's still better to have men and landowners voting than have no one voting, I think, you know.
Yeah. You're right. And that's actually a thing I've read. I've been rereading a lot of some of my favorite stuff from ancient Greek history, the era, the post-Alexander era. And that's a thing. You'll have sliding scale on democracy where at one point 30,000 Greeks were voting in Athens, and then it was reduced to about 12,000. And then it was brought back up to, because based on how many people are citizens, based on what the threshold is, what the cutoff is, it's like modern voting laws, like certain people are excluded. We exclude very few people, like maybe based on age, you know, but certain, obviously other things get used, like criminal convictions, or in some countries it's failure to pay taxes, which is really evil because then you get into debt slavery and your money is directly tied to whether you can vote, which is, that's wrong. That's not good. So at least by our modern values. Anyway.
It seems like a natural course, a step in the right direction. It has to go through that, but it seems to be something that has naturally happened many times over the course of history. So
on the subject of like taxes and voting, one initiative that I think is like interesting, promising, is the idea of a tax credit for voting.
Oh.
If you get a tax credit for voting, it incentivizes voting. It doesn't penalize you for voting. So it kind of, anyway.
Yeah, I think there are some countries that already do that.
Yeah,
right?
Huh? Some countries do stuff like that. Yeah, exactly. Variation. You know, there's different ways. Basically, but the idea to, like, again, incentivize voting makes sense.
Give people the day off of work. Like,
yeah, that's
only
the
if
biggest thing they could do, is just make that a national holiday and no one has to work and people will be more likely to vote, but that won't happen. Anyways, for sure.
Yeah, so there are, so there's, this is the opposite of that. We're instead of encouraging people to participate, these old systems, Earth, Planetos, whatever, keep the power in as few hands as possible, because the people at the top want as fewer people below them controlling their lives, because they feel entitled to do whatever they want.
You know, I wonder if George is meaning to have a parallel with these three princes, to having three branches of government, like legislation, judicial, and executive, or whatever, which, by the way, Iceland has. Mm. And I think Iceland also has, I don't think it's like a three-party system per se, but I wish I knew a little bit better, but I seem to remember reading somewhere that it's some sort of plurality as opposed to majority. So they don't devolve into a two-party system because they just need a group with the most votes. So they end up having at least three parties consistently.
Okay, that's good.
Again, not sure if George meant that, but it is another.
We saw a similar thing when we talked about Valyria and the freehold with Athens having three leaders as well.
Mm-hmm.
Three that are elected, the archon, and then the military leader, the religious leader, and the government leader, I believe it was, if I have that correct. In summary, on the peoples there, you have mazemakers, then the hairy men, then the Andals. And the Andals wiped out the hairy men. Then the Valyrians wiped out the Andals. And the Boeish worshippers came in. And then the Boeish worshippers didn't get wiped out. They were supplanted by migrations from all over. And it has a Bravos feel, because one of the things that's mentioned specifically is escaped slaves, religious outcasts. Bravos is a religious freedom place. So just, and as well as just general randoms, you know, it's a place where you can go. It's more, it's got open doors. Unlike a lot of other places, they're more restrictive to move there. There's not as many things you have to do to be allowed to live there, to be a citizen. They're probably, you're a lot less likely to get like suddenly drafted by, you know, like, let's grab all the foreigners and make them fight for us or something like that. There's a lot less likely to be some sort of upheaval. So it's safer in that sense. It's less likely to be invaded from the outside. So that's, again, really building on this idea of it being this out of the way place. But not too out of the way. right? That's what I said at the beginning. He still has that vague aspect to it. And this has been going on for some time. This is why I pointed out the Rhoynar and their destruction and tried to place that in the timeline here, because that happened after the Bosh worshippers went to Lorath. So some Rhoynar probably ended up at Lorath. It's a long way around, right? You got to go all the way around because they probably didn't go overland. But still, probably some of them went there. There's probably a few. And to this day, they're also helping to support Soth, as we recall. There's that one colony that's still, or that one city of Tallmen, the Tegea's Fen, the people from Sarnor. And Lorath apparently is tight with them in some way, some sort of mutual benefit going on there. They got their Morash colony nearby Soth, and Lorath sits over here. So that's neat. We also discussed Lorath briefly in the Stepstones episode. They came up. They were part of those wars between the Free Cities. They helped bring down the Triarchy, aka the Kingdom of the Three Daughters, with their allies Pentos and Braavos. The Triarchy was, of course, Myr, Lys, and Tyrosh. So that's six of the nine Free Cities getting involved in it there. And that brings us to an important question going forward. The fact that Lorath does get involved in global politics, and the fact that most of the cities seem poised to get involved in global politics towards the end of the series, one way or another, what side will Lorath take? It's a little easier to see in some other examples. Like Volantis, not going to be on Dany's side. not very likely. Pentos, I'm not really sure about Pentos. That's where Illyrio is, and she may come in conflict with him, and there's the Tattered Prince's claim on Pentos to take into account. So I'm not sure. Braavos, also hard to tell, because we've brought that up several times. Will they be anti-slavery? Or they're going to be pro-her because of the slavery, or anti-her because of the dragons? Lorath, similar question. What side will they take, if any? Yeah. Will they join her? Will they be against her? I really don't know.
Right now, it seems like it might be irrelevant, though. They don't even have enough military to control their own borders, right?
That's true.
Their own claim to the Lorath Bay can't really even be enforced. So
that might be an opportunity for them, though. If they're like, look, if we side with Dany, she might give us something, you know, as for taking her side, yeah. And it might help improve our city's fortunes going forward. So I'm thinking not just of during, but maybe at the end of the outlook, at the end of the series, maybe they've come out of it. Maybe they can leverage the coming conflict into something good for them. On the other hand, they're far north where it could get really, really wintry. They're not in Westeros, but they're not that far away. So, yeah. We haven't been to Lorath, of course, as you probably are aware, but we have spent a considerable amount of time in Braavos, which isn't far. They're both ports. There's a fair amount of traffic between the two. And my headcanon is that if you've ever had to catch an international flight when you live in a more rural area, you tend to have to travel to a bigger city to get to a bigger airport. So I think if you're like wanting to go to YT and you're in Lorath, you probably go to Braavos to find a ship going somewhere farther. You might be able to find one in Lorath, but you know, yeah. Could be similar to Harrenhal, right? Harrenhal was abandoned and not very powerful for so long, but it's, you know, a lot of different people have held it, but no one's kept it. Maybe it's vaguely a similar metaphor to what happened with Lorath. Constantly, just the people are there, constantly kicked out, destroyed, then taken over by someone entirely new, and then they lose it as well. So the structural pattern of Harrenhal is similar to Lorath. Okay, last topic for today, Jaqen H'ghar. Not truly from Lorath, but given he's a faceless man trained to be just like what he's pretending to be and do it well, he probably is a pretty accurate representation of that. Here's a quick quote from him.
This man has the honor to be Jaqen H'ghar, once of the Free City of Lorath. Would that he were home.
Would that he were home. Where is your actual home, though?
Yeah, are we sure that he's not from Lorath?
Yeah, well, probably. I mean, Arya asks about him, and to the kindly man, I don't know who that is, because it's just another disguise, most likely. Or he's lying, but probably just another disguise. Because we see him change his face into something that isn't Lorath.
He might be in the role of someone who was originally from Lorath.
That's true.
True self isn't.
That's true. You know, Arya wore the face of a real young girl, the ugly little girl or whatever. And
yeah, I mean, that was my guess. Memories. Was that face was from Laura.
Yeah.
That was a Lorathy face, Lorathy hair, all that. Just the person assuming the face isn't originally from Laura.
Yeah. So Jaqen may have been feeling the actual memories of a real Lorathy person. So Jaqen has the red hair, white hair thing going. That's a Lorathy custom, apparently. Not really sure what that speaks to. Is that metaphorical? Is that a symbolic of something religious or something about Lorath? I'm not really clear on that, but it's cool. It's presumably not a lower class thing, though, because hair dyes, not likely to be.
You know, I really wish we had
widely
a
Larathi. Available.
I really wish we had a Larathi here.
Oh, yeah? Why?
We could Larathi them that question.
Oh, we could Larathi them that question. What's the lore? We could ask them about their lore. And that manner of speech thing, you notice how Jochen speaks there. They don't refer to themselves in the first person. That's a religious thing. That's a relic of the blind god worshippers. Their customs mostly have fallen off, but that stuck. Especially the upper class of Lorath think it's just really gauche to refer to yourself in the first person. So it always refer to yourself in the third person. It's probably more widespread than just a nobility because it's a manner of speaking. And it's not like something you require money to do, like the hair dye. But still, it's interesting that Jochen chose this identity. Like, why choose to be Larathi? Again, I think it's because of this whole remote, but not too remote. Like, people will have heard of Lorath. The customs won't be familiar, but they won't be completely alien. And maybe that's part of making him seem a little dangerous, a little sinister. Like, Rorge and Biter were afraid of him. It could be because he just did some faceless man stuff in front of them, and they were like, oh my God. But, like, maybe it adds to the effect if he's a little foreign and speaks differently, but he's still speaking common, so it's not like a completely different language. So he's recognizable, but different. Am I going anywhere with that? Is this just my imagination? Can that make you seem a little more intimidating or a little more alien or something like that?
I think it can. I think it gives you the ability to lean into one or the other. Mm. You know, I don't know, you can play dumb, you know, like where I come from, blah, 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 you know,
yeah.
But you can also, that can be a sort of a wisdom, like, well, where I come from, we do da, da, da. You know, you get two cards to play, you know?
Yeah. That's true. Okay, I could see that. Yeah, so folks, if you have more thoughts on this, I'd love to hear your takes on why George may have chosen to make Jochen from Lorath of all the possible places. Would love to hear your thoughts on that or anything else about Lorath.
It's also right by Braavos, so knowing about one would make sense, you know, about the other.
That's true.
Being from one would give him more insight into the other. He could play the role better or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. It is, you know, House of Black and White's not, it's relatively close to Lorath compared to, like, say, the other free cities, so. Yeah, there would be a decent number. Like we said, there would be a decent number of Larathi in Braavos. And that would, yeah, maybe easier to fit that way. So yeah, pretty cool. I like that. Good stuff, folks. All right, let's begin our outro. Since Jochen isn't truly Larathi and he's very mysterious, there's not a whole lot we can say about him other than to point to the culture and the way he speaks as a nice example of differences within the world and something that may become relevant later. I would definitely like to see more Larathi, to see us go there, whether on TV or in short stories. I don't really think Dunk and Egg will go there, but hey, I guess you have to consider that a possibility. You never know. You never know where they'll go. There's a lot of Dunk and Egg stories. And some of it will be driven by the fandom. You know, a lot of what is yet to come is going to be determined by what we all express interest in, right? Like on a much larger scale, we have votes every week for what episode to do next. And, well, not all art is democratic or somewhat democratic like that. They're listening. You know, they're doing focus groups and testing and saying, well, what do people care about the most? Looking at data on the first Game of Thrones show, saw what people engaged with
the most,
which characters were the most popular.
If you want a sea snake show where he explores the world, when House of the Dragon comes out, you better tweet and talk about, hey, I want to see Yeti. Hey, I want to see the world. I want to see Corlys. You know, we got to show up and be vocal about what we want. We do.
Yeah. it goes double with a character like the Sea Snake, where there's, you know, extracurricular activity going on around that because of they made him black and all. And that is all the more important reason to stand up for that character because we want shows about him.
Yeah.
You know, don't let the negative people ruin it for the rest of us. Let's tell them what we want. Christina K, again, with a great comment here, says, you know, given the link between language and thought pattern, I wonder if the lack of pronouns in Lorath makes it easier for them to be faceless men. Oh, just the way language positions your own thoughts of identity.
The rest of the comments are about this that I have there, so you'd want to continue.
Okay, cool. Dornish Dame says, I wondered something similar, Christina, that detachment from the sense of self. And that detachment from self in Lorath is interesting given it is somewhere John considers sending Arya, who has been learning how to detach her identity. Great comment, Dornish Dame. Christina K responds, exactly, and it definitely happens. Gendered languages like the Romance languages do change the way people think about gender. Yeah, Yeah, if you're an American learning Spanish, you find out that almost every word has gender attached to it. Sometimes it's confusing. It's like, why? Why do some of these words have gender attached to them? Why are we gendering like basic items, you know?
You're like, why are we adding pronouns to basic actions?
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, that really speaks with the blind god stuff with them. They're eunuchs. They like degender themselves as much as they can.
You know, I think that's another thing in Iceland. I think that they don't, really? I wish I could be a little more certain, but I don't even think they would use Mr. or Mrs. They just call everyone by their name.
Interesting. And Mr. and Mrs. is a great example of like imbalance. It's like there's Mr., but then there's Mrs. and Miss, those are two different things. But Mr. is the same no matter what. It's like, well, why? There was a reason. It's just not a very good reason.
I see here Icelandic culture does not typically use honorifics. So this is someone talking about like talking to professors. You know, if
so you don't
like
use Mr., Mrs. or professor or...
Yeah, it says, the use of honorifics in Iceland is very limited today. So it does seem, according to this Reddit thread, perhaps that is the case.
You know, a lot of that comes from like military culture, you know, honorific sir, ma'am, and colonel, general, whatever. And as you pointed out, Sean, they don't really have a military there. So there would be lesser military culture, maybe less hierarchical thinking in that regard. That's cool. Very cool. Thank you for the takes. I once again am impressed by the knowledge of those of you who are coming live and commenting ahead of time. Adds quite a lot to our discussion. All right. The trivia question. The question was, which location has multiple wonders of the world? The answer is, it was mentioned in this episode. The answer is Norvos. Norvos has both the Great Bells, which are man-made, and the caves. We've talked about some cool cave systems and mazes around the world, but only Norvos's are considered a world wonder, so... They're even more impressive, apparently, than some of these others.
Notable about the Bells of Norvos, for our Lomas Longstrider episode coming up, we're looking at getting some art commissioned of the Three Bells of Norvos. So you have that to look forward to.
Yeah, right on. Next week, we'll be discussing, as voted on by patrons, the Clans of the Vale. That includes their history, that includes Nettles and the Sheep Stealer, that includes... what might be coming for them in after they've gotten equipped by Tyrion. they're definitely a Chekhov's clansman because their role in the story is certainly not done. So we'll talk about that as well as the other details and culture that are part of that topic. As usual, you can support us in a number of ways. For a long time, you've been able to support us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/historyofwesteros, where you can get bonus episodes, access to scripts and notes, and participating in these polls. You can also go to our website, historyofwesteros.com, and send a donation. We will send you links to all our bonus episodes. Or you can, if you have a Spotify Anchor account, you can subscribe to us through there. That's the newest option. It just adds on to your existing Spotify bill. $5 a month. Get all our bonus episodes. We're in the process of uploading them one or two a week. Eventually, they'll all be there. They show up on your Spotify feed as paid subscriber episodes. That $5 a month will unlock all of them. And by the time we're done, there's going to be more than 10. I don't have a full count, but there's a lot of them. We keep adding to them, and there's more coming. So that's a great way to support us, as well as getting some additional content. Thank you all. Thanks for those of you who came live. Thanks to Nina for the great notes. Check out Good Queen Alley with 1L.tumblr.com. Joey, Jesse, and Kevin, thank you very much for the music. Thanks to our Benjineer for the sound quality assistance. Thanks to Michael Klarfeld for the great maps you see behind me and our video intro. Thanks to the mods, both on Facebook and Discord. And then, of course, folks, don't forget what Ashea said about SDCC. If you're going to be in San Diego, or especially if you're actually going to the con, reach out to us, westeroshistory@gmail.com, or just hit us up on one of the social media places or Twitter.
Yeah.
At Westeros History or at Mirani's Not. Also, or Sean at Dancing Sean.
Yeah, also on Discord, I have updated some of the roles and stuff like that. So if you haven't been on Discord for a while, go check out the roles channel and look at that to get. You can I have it set so that you could give yourself the Crusader Kings role or the Jackbox Games role. And then when we are gaming, you can get alerts about it. So
it's like opting in to just receive messages about. Yeah. Things that relate to that role.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and there's other cool things in the Discord, but that is one future because we haven't played Jackbox or Quiplash in the Discord yet, but I would like to soon.
Yeah, one of these days we'll pull that off. We've done obviously done Jackbox in a lot of other places. It's always a great time.
Yeah, we've streamed like it and had some private chats.
We will see you all next week for more Velar Re-Reach.